Klaus Sonnleitner has just ended his recital on the organ of the Royal Albert Hall with Bach's magnificent Prelude and Fugue in A minor, BWV 543, which you're hearing live on BBC Radio 3, the home of the Proms. When I first spoke to Klaus Sonnleitner about what he'd made of this amazing, majestic instrument, he came out with a very unexpected reaction. "Charming, charming," he said. "I've never before heard the Father Willis organ described in quite that way." Standing at the organ bench and taking a bow, the same could be said of the man himself. Klaus Sonnleitner radiates happiness. He goes around with a permanent smile on his face, obviously absolutely loving what he does. A characteristically joyous encore from Klaus Sonnleitner. Bach's Chorale Prelude in Dir ist Freude, BWV 651, music for New Year from Bach's Orgelbuchlein. Old meeting new there, since Klaus Sonnleitner used a 4-foot flute of the sort Bach would have recognized, together with the carillon stop. That's miniature bells for you and me, tinkling away deep inside the innards of the Royal Albert Hall organ. And that very much a 19th century invention. Here he is once again. Very nice to see the organ lit up tonight in all its magnificent, monumental, gilded splendour. He combines his post as organist at the monastery of St. Florian Linz, the post Anton Bruckner held from 1851, with being chaplain at the parish church of Linz-Ebelsberg. Well, earlier I asked Klaus Sonnleitner what it feels like to be the heir to the Bruckner tradition, sitting on the same organ bench he once occupied and playing the instrument he knew so well.
I think that most of the pipe work is almost in original condition of the 19th century. And therefore, it's the feeling Bruckner might have had when he played here. In comparison to my organ, the Bruckner organ in St. Florian in Upper Austria, in my abbey, this organ has been rebuilt several times, and also the sound did change. But it is the Bruckner organ, and Bruckner is lying in the sarcophagus directly beneath the organ in the crypt. And I know every time that I play the organ, Bruckner is still there.
Klaus Sonnleitner. Well, after the interval, the platform here in the Royal Albert Hall, which is currently completely deserted, will be rather crowded with the large orchestra. Tonight, the Vienna Philharmonic required to play Anton Bruckner's Eighth Symphony. A performance will be conducted by Lauren Marzell. Well, that'll be in 20 minutes' time. Meanwhile, we're going to hear the results of the 2013 Proms Poetry Competition. The results announced a little while ago across the road in the Royal College of Music. The winners are introduced by the poet Don Patterson and the writer and Radio 3 broadcaster Ian McMillan.
There are many important moments in the literary year. The 16th of June will always be Bloomsday for readers of James Joyce. For fans of Clement Seymour, December the 24th will always be the night before Christmas, and it will for everybody else, actually, whether you've read the poem or not. For Ian McEwan's readers, the weekend will always begin with Saturday, and Alan Sillitoe's many followers will always treasure that audible click when Saturday night becomes Sunday morning. Well, tonight, here on Radio 3, we're adding a new date to that calendar, the 6th of September, that red-letter day when we announce the winners of this year's Proms Poetry Competition. Joining me here on stage are my fellow judges, Don Patterson and Judith Palmer, for our associates on the competition this year, the Poetry Society. The actor Samantha Bond will be reading the winning entries, and of course our winners. Please welcome them. So let me remind you of the rules. There were two categories, 12 to 18 and 19 to infinity. And to enter, you had to write a poem inspired by a piece of music performed at this year's Proms concerts. Inspired by could be interpreted as widely as you like. The poem could be about the experience of seeing and hearing the work performed. It could spark memories for the writer. Or the poem could be an attempt to recreate that piece of music in language. So let's start by hearing one of the runners-up in the over 18 category. Sid and Signor by Isabel White, inspired by Piazzolla's Oblivion. So, Samantha, could you read it for us?
Sinuous as ever, Charisse dips hips and slips around her sharp suitor, newly undone, leg over truculent leg. Forehead to forehead, in practiced proximity to his entreating lips, Sid spins, romances his bones, fingers bass and treble clavicle, leg in, toe out. Her accompanist, Astor's abandoned bandoneon, Breath of Argentina.
That was the only poem inspired by that particular piece of music, and I think that helped it to float to the top of the pile in many ways. So, Judith, what did you particularly like about that poem?
I think the form was the thing I noticed first, actually. I liked the snakiness that kind of conveyed the tango, just that little hint of tango, and the little staccato bits you get in tango as well, of the dips, hips, slips. So, yeah, I thought it really worked well with the music it was trying to convey.
Now, Don, you're a composer and performer yourself, and you've written poems inspired by music. So how easy is it, do you think, to write about music?
Well, it's never a good idea to write about anything, I think. You can write about it, but usually in poetry you use the about as a sort of pretext to write about the thing you were really interested in writing about. Yeah. That's not to say things still can't be about the literal subject. So this is still about a tango, but it's also about a dancing with death in that way. I love the way it's used as an excuse to address that.
So a poem can, a subject then, can often be a way into the subject behind the subject.
I think that's it. I think it's often just a pretext, and that's what's interesting about this competition, is the way that people have used that in different ways, you know, to write things they probably wanted to write about but didn't have a legitimate excuse.
Now, it's time for the first winner of this year's competition, Jonathan Davidson, whose poem is called The Silence and was inspired by Arvo Pärt's Cantus in Memoriam Benjamin Britten.
I like best the silence that is not silence, but our breathing. The orchestra of flesh and thought caught in looped arpeggios. But back to the silence that comes at the start and finish and places a hand on our shoulder or takes our hands and leads us not to heaven or hell, but into the everlasting place of unknowing from where we issued forth. But back to the silence that for us on the surface of the earth is nothing like silence, but a continuous roar of obligation and dispatch, of coming and going. And for Benjamin Britten was the great bell tolling and then not tolling. And that is what I like best, the silence that is noisy like the bell that we go back to from where we came.
Thanks very much. Jonathan, that is a lovely poem. Tell us about the genesis of it. How did you actually start to write it, having heard the piece of music?
Well, I've been listening to the piece of music for 27 years. Mm. I knew it really well, not as a musician at all. I'm not a musician in any way. So just as a listener, in fact, when I sat down to write the poem, I didn't even need to listen to the piece again. I knew exactly what it did to me. I liked the idea that the music felt like it was coming out of a silence and then very definitely disappearing into a silence. It's a sort of almost a concept piece of music. It has this idea, and it just throws that idea at you. In fact, it has two ideas, one of the main swell of the music and the second of the bell. And it kind of crosses those two ideas in the space of however many few minutes it is. It's quite a short piece. So I wanted to write about how we come out of silence and go into it. I'm interested in the fact that both music and poetry are just sounds introduced into silence. And whenever I write a piece of anything, I write the word silence at the start, not that I'm going to use it, and write the word silence at the end, because I know I will start with silence and I will finish with silence. And all I've got to do is to fill in the bits in between. How difficult can that be? So it was a piece that gave me, because it has such energy and such a directness and such a power, it gave me that structure already. But I also wanted to slightly backpedal on that and to kind of try and almost undermine myself by consciously referring to the silence, just to test whether I really had a grip on that idea or not.
That was the thing that struck me and the other judges, just that repetition of the word silence. Now, and the way you've described it there, though, by starting each poem that you write by writing the word silence at the top and the word silence at the bottom, doesn't that place you as the poet in some kind of real huge sense of responsibility to fill the thing in between, as you say?
It does, and it's why I don't write very many poems, or certainly don't finish very many poems, because I feel all you can do is mess it up, and normally you do mess it up. The repetition also echoed the bell, the fact that this bell is repeated in the piece and we keep on coming back to it as listeners. So it was slightly echoing that structure as well. I was writing about what I felt was a work of musical genius because I'd listened to it for such a long time and it never fails to move me. It was a burden to carry that idea of that piece of music on my shoulders temporarily. I wanted to do a service to the piece and not to hang on its coattails, but to temporarily move alongside it for a very brief period of time. Obviously, Arvo Pärt is out of this world as a composer. All I can do is jog along for a short period of time with that little poem. So, yes, I suppose it was a burden.
But then we've talked about the practical thing of entering a competition. And did you do things in that poem that you knew would catch our eye? Because that's what we've talked about, the way that the judge should be startled.
I don't think I did, no. I, as most poets probably, you write to satisfy your own, hopefully very demanding self. And you want to be pleased and astonished about what you've written. And also, most importantly, you want to come down next morning and still feel that there's something there I mean, that is the test, as you probably know, Ian. Mm. You know, we all write works of genius at around midnight.
Yes.
And at around 7 a.m., they're not necessarily so good. So I was looking to be surprised, and in fact, re-looking at the poem in the last few days when I knew I was coming here, I see things in it that I was obviously not consciously aware of. And that pleases me because, you know, you want to surprise yourself and then hopefully you'll surprise and please others.
What I liked about the poem very much was the repetition of the silence. That took me into it to start with. What was it that you liked about the poem, Don?
I like the fact that it kind of enacted its own subject in its telling. I'm always, I mean, it seems sort of self-reinforcing. I mean, the truth is that I don't know what I liked about it because I was disarmed by it, you know, and when I read it, I forgot I was supposed to be judging a poetry competition, which is the kind of highest compliment you can pay these things. You know, but I can see now what I was attracted to, and it's the way that Jonathan has kind of admitted the silence into the poem, not just through the pattern of its silences, not just through the repetition of the word silence, but the really subtle use of things like sibilance, you know. If you listen to, but back to the silence that for us on the surface of the earth is nothing like silence but a continuous, then a wonderful line, roar of obligation and dispatch, which leaps out at you against this kind of sort of gas seep that's been going through the last few lines. So it's a lovely kind of pendulum swinging between noise and silence that the poem itself enacts, which is, I assume, what the music was doing too.
And Judith, what did you make of it?
Well, I loved that opening, silence that is not silence. And often poems do have a great first line, but often they can't sustain it, and this poem sustained it. Mm. It made you think about the act of listening on the radio. I love that moment where the presenter stops and you don't quite know when the baton's going to be raised and quite when the first note's going to come. And you know sometimes it's a little bit later than the presenter was thinking, and not quite knowing. And so it had all of that about it. I found it really interesting what you were saying about the silence. It was making me think about, you know, all that extra white space that you get around a poem that you don't get in a piece of prose. So it's a nice connection.
And I think as readers, we like mystery in poems. And those last three lines, and that is what I like best, the silence that is noisy like the bell that we go back to from where we came. That's got a fantastic mystery about it. And what, I don't want to unlock the mystery, Jonathan, but what is that? What's behind that, do you think?
Well, the piece of music is a big piece of music, I think, emotionally. It's about a man's life and the end of a man's life. I consciously wanted to write a poem that echoed that attempt to put the idea of someone entering the world and leaving the world. And, of course, those are very difficult subjects to write about as poets because so many other people have written about them wonderfully, and you can look like you're just echoing somebody else's sentiments and not really approaching your own. So I wanted to both have a sort of rather classical summing up at the end of the poem, but also give a sense of, well, actually, beyond the noise we've just made as human beings or as poets or musicians, we know nothing about the rest, and we can know nothing about the rest. And I quite often remind myself that all this is an extraordinary mystery, the very fact that we're here at all, and that we can make beautiful sounds with musical poetry, and music particularly. You know, the reason I would be a composer if I could be a composer, which I can't, is because they move you in a way that I cannot understand how it works. I cannot deconstruct it, and I know people can deconstruct music and explain how this makes you feel like that and so on, and there are all sorts of people putting electrodes on foreheads to try and work it out, but I'm just content with thinking it does something magical and mysterious. And this piece of music is about, I think, the mystery of human life arriving, acting, and then departing.
I mean, if ever there was a composer who loved and understood poetry, it was Benjamin Britten, so I think it's beautiful as well that that Britten had played a part in then inspiring a poem, when normally he was setting them afterwards.
Let's hear now the winner of the 12 to 18 category. Dylan Leet's poem is called Rivers and Streams and was inspired by Harmony by Julian Anderson, which was a BBC commission and a world premiere. Sam.
The summer our neighbour's kitten died and Mum sold her pearls, I took you to the river for the first time. The air was heavy like steamed glass, blurring your skin into the sky as you edged along the bank. A new white dress clung to your kneecaps and not hips, as you cracked the ripples with your big toe, squealing at the cold. Sea glass gleamed from the muddy bed, but as you leant to look, the foam grew layers of lips and swallowed you, like daylight. I grabbed for your hand, but you spun away, laughing. Pondweed tangled in your toes as you spat spray like a waterfall. The river water sliced streaks along your dress until I could count freckles scattered like cattle across your spine. I tried to follow, but the rapids cackled like a white-haired stepmum. So I sat on an oak and waited for you to pull yourself out on a low branch. Nosy clouds followed us home and watched us murmur excuses to Mum. She sighed and scrubbed us in her clawfoot tub until we were pink and clean like empty stomachs. The little white dress was too stained to wear again.
That's a lovely poem, Dylan. Tell us how long you've been writing.
I've been writing short stories since I was 4 or 5, and you had to fill in those diaries about what you did in your weekend. I would just make it up. But I've been writing poems since I was 9 or 10, but more seriously in the past couple of years.
And why do you think in the last couple of years it's taken on more seriousness for you?
Because I think I started to appreciate how much you could say with a few words, and how if you spend more time choosing them as opposed to just writing lots and lots, how much of a message you can get across. And I've been really lucky to be able to meet some different poets who have been really inspiring and work with them, and that was really exciting, so that got me writing more.
And how did you come to write this particular poem?
I listened to Julian Anderson's piece on the first night of the performance, and I thought it was really beautiful and I really connected with it. And I loved the way the fragility at the beginning sort of built up almost without you noticing it into something big and grand. And it reminds me of what I've got various younger siblings and younger cousins, and sort of watching someone that you thought was really small and delicate grow up and become like their own person without really noticing it. And there was a connection there with me that I wanted to write about.
It was for me, Judith, to start with, the images that jumped out at me, the image of the freckles scattered like cattle across your spine. What a great line. What was it that attracted you to this poem?
Oh, well, that line, the pink and clean like empty stomachs, like you, that was it. But it was a very noisy poem. I liked the squealing and the cracking, which felt, you know, if you're writing about music, you know, I liked the fact that it was noisy. And it was surprising, gripped you from the start and then just continued to surprise you.
What about you, Don? What did you like of the poem?
I forgot to read the box that you ticked to say what category it was in, and I assumed it was in for the adult competition, so I'd had it as one of my sort of front runners in the adult competition. So that was the main... So that was something. And then I was even more surprised to discover the youth of the author. But I think it displays the most beautiful musical ear throughout. No kind of gratuitous sound effects, but, you know, sort of sound effects throughout that are all in the service of the images that they describe and make the noise of the thing that's actually happening in the poem, with the result that the whole thing is a beautiful, vivid, noisy tumble down the page.
Of course, if I'd entered this competition, say if I was 16 when I entered this competition, my poems would have been full of anguish to start with and abstract nouns. I'd have been so anguished and I'd have been in despair. And I'd have been in love, and there'd have been a bit of fury and a bit of sadness. And this poem avoids that, doesn't it, somehow, Judith? And there is a danger in that kind of poem written when you're a young person and you're first starting to write poems. There's a danger that you will write that kind of poem that I just described.
Well, there's no danger, there's no harm in writing that poem first, but Dylan mentioned about redrafting and getting interested in redrafting. Mm. That's the key, really. Get the words down. There may be emotion there. It may be all pouring out, but you can then stop, go back to it, control that emotion, and, you know, just make sure there's the humour and the surprise. And often, you know, with teenage poetry, the huge flights of the surreal, people not afraid to just say what comes into their head rather than thinking, I'm going to copy this person or whatever. So I don't think you need to be worried about any pitfalls. Just get them down, but then just look at them and carefully go through and see what you can take out.
And what I like about this as well is that it's a poem about a world premiere. This was the first time this piece of music had been heard. And what I like about that, Don, is that we haven't had a chance to have our opinions about that piece of music settled yet. So we had a lot of poems about Like Ascending because we kind of know what that's about. But this was a world premiere. And that... that helps with the poem somehow, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's probably something to do with the fact that, you know, you know a lack of sounding and your own responses to it are partly fixed, and then you hear someone else's and you go, no, it's not like that at all, you know? And I didn't know this, so that was in the clear, really. So it was just, I was happy to take it absolutely on trust. It's a sort of perverse thing that when, you know, sort of people write about pieces of art or pieces of music that mean a lot to you, you're sort of tyrannical in your own opinion of what they actually mean. But of course, they have infinite possibility. Sometimes you don't want infinite possibility.
Let's end by hearing both the runners-up in the 12 to 18 section, The Outpouring by Alice Cattley, inspired by Beethoven's Fifth, and first, The Way the Waitress Turned Her Head by Jake Reynolds, inspired by Wagner's Das Rheingold.
The way the waitress turned her head to me. I flinched, dropped my bread in my soup, looked around to see if anyone else was there. My cottage cheese shirt smattered with soup, arterial red, like the spoiled wall of a crime scene. The way the waitress turned her head, was it anger on her part or paranoia on mine? My toes in my shoes, slimy with sweat, retreating like snail's eyes, my lip bitten red raw. The way the waitress turned her head, in profile, like the fire escape was moonlight, like she heard a distant call, forgot her keys, felt a sudden urge to sneeze, but looking at me. The way the waitress turned her head, the way my eyes vibrated, the awkward way I could no longer hold my cutlery. Now I feared holding the jug of water in case it slipped and fell. The way the waitress turned her head. I had to leave that second. Taxis too late, buses unreliable, I ran all the way home and set about moving house. In the rush of rain and white noise, the harmony had lost its anchor. Horsehair, unloosed from the clasp of the bow, joined hooves that racked with rubato through the waves. Cellos, flung against rocks, bled splinters into salt and sang all the while to plugged ears. What could you hear, tied to the mast and fighting against the ropes that bound you? The hammering of the rain on the roof? The radio in the dashboard? Ist das wie das Schicksal an die Pforte pocht?
Well, that's all we have time for tonight. Just time to say very well done to all our winners and to everybody who entered the competition.
That was Ian McMillan with Don Patterson, Judith Palmer, and the winners of this year's Proms Poetry Competition. The reader was Samantha Bond, and the producer was Fiona McLean. Welcome back to tonight's prom, the next to last night of the 2013 season. In this second part of the concert, the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra is on stage, and they're about to perform a single work, Bruckner's Eighth Symphony. Bruckner was already 40 by the time he wrote what he counted as his symphony number one. He was almost 60 when he embarked on this symphony, the last one he completed, and his work on it extended over 8 years. I asked Lauren Marzell if he feels there's any sense of that protracted gestation as we listen to this mammoth symphony.
It hangs very well together now. It's the 1890 version. It's not long-winded. It's not repetitive. It's a masterpiece. And I was very pleased to read that at the first performance, he had a gigantic success after every movement. And he had not been all that successful up to that time. So to see it well received and to have the feeling that all was not in vain is a wonderful feeling. And I'm very happy for him that he had it when he could still enjoy it.
Tonight's conductor, Lauren Marzell. The Eighth is the longest and widest ranging of Bruckner's symphonies. One critic called it Promethean in its aim, Faustian in spirit, all-embracing in its emotional ambit, spanning the gulf from religious sublimity to upper Austrian pastoral idyll. Bruckner himself regarded it as his finest. None of his symphonies had a more troubled and complicated gestation, and yet, at the time of its conception, the auguries had never been more promising. Bruckner was enjoying his first success. His seventh symphony had been performed in Leipzig under the great conductor Arthur Nikisch, and it was a genuine triumph. It looked as if Bruckner's music was about to achieve acceptance and understanding for the first time. That applause for the Vienna Philharmonic coming on stage. Well, after 3 years of work, Bruckner wrote to his friend and supporter, the conductor Hermann Levy, whose opinion was crucial to him. When Levy rejected the new symphony as unperformable, Bruckner was totally devastated. Levy was well aware of what the effect of his verdict would be on Bruckner and actually got his pupil, Josef Schalk, to break the news. As a result, Bruckner seems to have suffered what we would call a nervous breakdown. He was cast into such a deep depression, we know he contemplated killing himself, not for the first time. It took him 2 years to summon the necessary resources before he threw himself into a fit of what's been called revision mania, embarking on full-scale reworkings of five of his symphonies, including the eighth. Work on that continued over another 3 years. The symphony opens up its own harmonic world into which Bruckner blends the archaic element of majestic brass chorales. He gave some enigmatic hints as to what lay behind this profound and mysterious work. The scherzo and final movement, he said, were haunted by Der Deutsche Michael, a proverbially naive figure from German folklore. With the adagio, he alluded to a young girl's eye into which he had gazed too deeply. The coda, he said, reminded him of what he called a Totenuhr. It's like, he said, when somebody's dying and opposite them hangs the clock, which ticks on with its regular beat, even as their life draws to an end. Tick-tock, tick-tock. Well, up to this point, Bruckner had placed the slow movement second and the scherzo third. But in the case of the eighth, he follows the pattern of Beethoven's ninth and reverses that order. His scherzo is unleashed with ferocious energy, pounding, as the composer Robert Simpson put it, like some colossal engine of Milton's imagining. Bruckner uses Wagner tubas again, as he did in the Seventh Symphony in the first two movements, and there's a new addition to his orchestra in this symphony. Hitherto, Bruckner had declared that the harp doesn't belong in a symphony. Now he changed his mind. It's the vast adagio, though, which is the heart of the Eighth Symphony, as Bruckner lifts us into a transcendent and spacious world whose gates only he can open to us. Well, as you can hear, a modicum of tuning there, the leader of the orchestra, Rainer Hoenig, is already on stage. And just appearing out of the ball run, here to conduct the Vienna Philharmonic in Bruckner's Symphony No. 8 is Lorin Mazel.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
and at last, Transfiguration, the transcendent ending of the Symphony No. 8, the last symphony he completed by Anton Bruckner. We've just heard it in a transcendent performance by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Lorin Maazel. Conducting as ever without a score tonight. He did have a music stand, but all that was on it, and it's still there, though now empty, a bottle of Royal Albert Hall water with which he refreshed himself soberly between the movements. Calls there for the Wagner tubas. Lars Michael Stransky, Franz Obermüller, Behan Christoph and Markus Uppmann. And the horns. Conducting without a score has been a trademark of Maazel since he was a very young man, taking over at very short notice a concert nobody else wanted to do in Catania. He knew three of the pieces and he learned the fourth, Smetana's Bartered Bride Overture, on the 17-hour train journey. It was one rehearsal and then the performance. He hadn't slept for 48 hours, but he conducted the whole program from memory and, he says, apparently I brought it off. Well, as I think you can tell from that noise, he seems to have brought it off once again. Standing, applauding the 90 members of the Vienna Philharmonic on the platform tonight. They're currently on a European tour which will take them on from here to Lübeck, Freiburg and Paris with this program and another which includes Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony and a brand new percussion concerto. Well, tomorrow night it's the big finish, of course. Joyce DiDonato and Nigel Kennedy will be here with their friends, the BBC Symphony Chorus and the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and Marin Alsop making history as the first woman to conduct the last night of the Proms, and it's only taken 118 years. Wagner, Britten, Bernstein, Handel, Rossini, Arlen, Monti, Trad, Elgar and Parry, of course, plus a new piece by Anna Klein called Masquerade. The fun kicks off, as ever, at 7:30. As the applause continues, time for me to hand you back to John Shea in Broadcasting House to take you through the rest of the Radio 3 evening.
Thank you very much, Donald MacLeod. A transcendent performance indeed. Donald MacLeod presenting that concert, which, as with all of our live proms, you can listen to for the next 7 days via the Radio 3 website. Now look ahead to tomorrow morning and summer CD review.
It's been quite a year for Benjamin Britten's music and for tenor Ian Bostridge, who's my guest this week, talking to me about recording Britten's songs, his War Requiem, and about getting evangelical in Bach's Passions. There's brand new Bach from the Dunedin consort as well, the Brandenburg Concertos. Marin Alsop's recording of Brahms's German Requiem. And I'll be exploring a set of pianist Leon Fleischer's complete studio recordings. Plus Wagner's Das Rheingold, the latest instalment of the Mariinsky Ring cycle from Valery Gergiev. I'm Andrew McGregor. I hope you'll join me for the last edition of Summer CD Review before the return of Building a Library after its summer break. Saturday mornings from 9 here on BBC Radio 3.
Next, this Friday evening on BBC Radio 3, Will Self presents our feature Modernism Redux. That's in a couple of minutes after a little more Bach organ music. Thank you.
From J.S. Bach's Orgelbüchlein, that was the chorale prelude Herr Christ, der einige Gottes Sohn. Simon Preston playing the organ of the Klosterkirche in Sorø in Denmark. BBC Radio 3, it's 10:15, and now another chance to hear one of our features from earlier in the year, Modernism Redux, in which the writer Will Self looks at the legacy of cultural and literary modernism and examines how the response to the modern world by writers such as Virginia Woolf, James Joyce and T.S. Eliot in 1922 presaged our world of computers, instant communications and social media. He also looks at our ambivalence to modernism, seeing how we've embraced it as a society while disavowing it in our reading habits. First, though, he needs to introduce us to a very special machine.
Good evening. As a writer of recondite fiction and acerbic journalism, I wouldn't seem the logical person to announce something momentous in the realm of technology, yet that's what I'm about to do. Why the BBC should have chosen me to introduce this remarkable piece of equipment will, I hope, become apparent as I talk to its restorer and current operator, James Cook of the Archival Unit. But to begin with, I need to tell you a little about the origins of the Remitter itself. That's right, the Remitter. It's widely known that the first radio transmitters began operating in 1922, initially with the Marconi 2MT station in Essex, then with the 2LO station broadcasting from the Strand in London, which was subsequently incorporated into the BBC. However, what's remained virtually unknown until the present day, the exceptions being some mole-like technicians who have adapted to life in the crepuscular basements beneath Broadcasting House, is that at the same time, the valves, rheostats, filament resistors and bias batteries of the first transmitters were being assembled, a prototype Remitter was also being built. The aim of this experimental machine was to retrieve or remit past radio signals out of the air. The pioneers of broadcasting technology understood that once transmitted, no matter how widely dispersed they may be, radio waves still retain informational content in what physicists describe as ideoform matrices. The remitter would condense and then recombine these into remissions, the recapitulation of previous transmissions. The first remissions were gathered only from the immediate vicinity, a matter of a few hundred yards, and the immediate past, the last hour or two. Of course, in the context of the excitement generated by the early broadcasts, the ability to rehear them seemed comparatively uninteresting. The RP1 Ethermatic Remitter thus languished, a disused heap of coils, wires, and circuit boards, for many decades. Until last year, when, as part of a general clear-out instigated by the construction of New Broadcasting House, the remitter came to light. Restoration work revealed that the equipment still functioned, and that, moreover, the fundamental principles of remission being basically sound, when united with the far more powerful radio reception equipment of our own era, the RP1 became capable of retrieving signals from the entire history of broadcasting and from all corners of the earth. So, James Cook, can you tell us a little bit about how the RP1 Ethermatic Remitter works?
Well, welcome to the archive. Yes, I can. It's an original piece of 1922 technology, and essentially the principles behind it are very simple. That if you can broadcast into the ether, in effect, you could surely create a machine that could withdraw or remit, as they called it at the time, broadcast signals out of the ether.
You've bolted onto the front of it a very conventional-looking laptop computer, but the background of it is still, you know, these very antiquated and large and clunky circuit boards. I can see Bakelite switches in there and original valves.
Yes, that's right. No, it's absolutely it's the core of the original machine, which, as far as we know, was developed in the early 20s, we think. We've certainly got evidence of it being prototype tested in 1922.
Mm.
It very much partakes of that original era of the development of radio technology. And indeed, I always think it looks rather like something that H.G. Wells could have invented. And you know, and Wells knew his science. It's conceivable that something like this could have ended up in one of his works.
Yes, I mean, one of the most beautiful descriptions in Wells is, of course, of the time machine itself, with its kind of crystal rods whirring round and round and kind of highly polished brass gimbals that kind of circle. It actually is a rather loving description of this technology.
And in fact, the time traveller himself, people forget that takes another invention into the future, which is a small device he wears around his neck that actually does record the sounds of the future and allows him to bring them back.
No, I'd completely forgotten that. So he is, in a way, a remitter of himself.
Exactly.
Approached by the BBC's archive department to discuss possible applications for this simultaneously revolutionary and reactionary technology, the coincidence between the first radio transmissions and the development of the RP1 in 1922 and the publication of both Joyce's Ulysses and Eliot's The Wasteland struck me forcibly. I proposed an investigation of the evolution of technology and culture using newly sourced remissions to create an air assemblage of modernist art and ideas. So now, if I understand you rightly, James, that the Ethernet remitter now, with this kind of front-end bolted computer, we can put in more or less any search term and it will find us and remit from the ether any broadcast material that employs that term, ranging back over the whole history of radio transmission.
Yeah. You can put in a search term or a series of search terms, and it will draw out of the ether a relevant broadcast.
Okay, I mean, I see that in principle, but I can't quite believe it's going to work in practice. I mean, for example, I don't know, if you put in Finnegan's Wake, are we going to get Joyce reading Finnegan's Wake, which I don't think was... I mean, it was broadcast, but I don't think ever recorded in
any
way.
Well, if you put in Finnegan's Wake plus Joyce.
Well, you know, or don't you, Kenneth, or haven't I told you, every telling has a tailing, and that's the he and the she of it. Look, look, the dusk is growing. My branches lofty are taking root, and my cold chair's gone ashly. Feel-o, feel-o, what age is that?
Well, I think we should just start off by seeing whether the remitter will bring up anything for modernism itself. I mean, what can we drag out of the airwaves?
MT 103
Search
Real One
Modernism. Living
on the verge of one of the greatest ages of English literature. There was James Joyce.
So it's actually searching through remitted transmissions at this point.
Yeah. A series of radically experimental works across different media that we will later come to call modernism.
There was D.H. Lawrence. There were Point Counterpoint, South Wind, and Passage to India. Poets, Harding, Yeats, de la Mer, Eliot.
Modernism rejects tradition and convention. Modernism rejects realism.
Virginia Woolf on words.
All we can say about them as we peer at them over the edge of their deep, dark, and only fitfully illuminated cavern in which they live, the mind, all we can say about them is that they seem to like people to think before they use them and to feel before they use them.
Modernism rejects rationality.
John Updike on Ulysses.
Returning us through simple language to the sensation is what makes Ulysses untedious, a kind of wonderful poem to the fact of consciousness.
From Ulysses by James Joyce, 1922.
Struck, quizzed, lit, puffed, savory puff after. Puff after stiff a puff, strong, savory, crackling. He puffed a pungent, plumy blast. Davy Byrne smiled, yawned, nodded all in one.
There's this rather strange disembodied or additional female voice that seems to be the kind of conscience of the remitter itself. What's that?
Yes, that's a new feature. That's Alice, as we've called her. Very simply, we've used search engine technology, so an algorithm effectively, to collate and tag the results. We've just vocalised it for Alice.
It's not presenting... Well, we'll get to the Alice in a minute. It's not presenting them hierarchically in any sense.
No, it's not that sophisticated.
Louis Armstrong plays Mac the Knife.
Dig, man! There goes Mac the Knife!
Letter, James Joyce to Nora Barnacle.
My beautiful wild flower of the hedges. My dark blue